Welcome to KUOW's Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, that sound you're hearing now, that's the sound of a large group of people gathering in a former church to talk about civic responsibility. Why? Well, people in search of a spiritual life often seek community. So what should people searching for civic communion do? You might take a civics class, join a political party, go door to door, or march. We could also stop by Town Hall Seattle on a given Saturday. Civic Saturday is the brainchild of Eric Liu and Janae Kane, co-founders of the Seattle-based nonprofit Citizen University. They call it the civic analog to church. Like church, it brings people together, but to ponder our civic lives. And like church, the gathering includes songs, readings of quote-unquote scripture, taken from great American texts, silent reflection, and a quote-unquote sermon. Eric Liu is an author and educator. His latest book is You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. He and the Citizen University team took to the stage at Town Hall Seattle on Saturday, April 8th. We didn't include the moments of silence for obvious reason, but our presentation will give you an idea of what goes on at Civic Saturday. Here, Janae Kane kicks off the event.
For those of you who have not been here, I just want to tell you a little cap of what we're doing. Civic Saturday is what we call a civic analog to church. It's a gathering of friends and strangers in a common place to nurture a spirit of shared purpose. But it's not about church religion or synagogue or mosque religion. It's about American civic religion, the creed of liberty, equality, and self-government that truly unites us, even as we argue over it. So thank you for being here. Here's what we're going to do today. We're going to have this assembly, and it's going to consist of some moments of reflection, some turn and talk to your neighbors, song, some readings of American scripture, a sermon, some more reflection, another song, and then we'll break for social hour. So thank you for being here.
Thanks, Janae. I'm Eric Liu. I am the husband of Janae Kane and co-founder of Citizen University. And I just wanted to introduce our awesome team that both puts together Civic Saturdays on a regular basis, but also runs all of our really fun and exciting programs. So please join me in welcoming Taylor, Ben, of course, Janae, Laurette, Deepa, Arista, Scott, and Lena. Thanks.
Next up, we're going to have readings from Sonia, Alec, and Zachara.
All right. Rebecca Solnit, author, born 1961, from a paradise born in hell, the extraordinary communities that arise in disaster. You can read recent history as a history of privatization, not just of the economy, but also of society, as marketing and media shove imagination more and more toward private life and private satisfaction, as citizens are redefined as consumers, as public participation falters, and with it, any sense of collective or individual political power, as even the language for public emotions and satisfaction withers. There's no money in what is aptly called free association. We are instead encouraged by media and advertising to fear each other and regard public life as a danger and a nuisance, to live in secured spaces, communicate by electronic means, and acquire our information from media rather than each other. But in disaster, people come together, and though some fear this gathering as a mob, many cherish it as an experience of a civil society that is close enough to paradise.
Our second reading is a quote from Carol Tavris, who is a social psychologist and feminist, And she wrote two books, Mistakes Were Made, But Not By Me, and, and The Misunderstood Emotion. Depression is not anger turned inward. If anything, anger is depression turned outward. Follow the trail of anger inward, and there you will find the small, still voice of pain. In the horrifying calculus of self-deception, the greater the pain we inflict on others, the greater the need to justify it, to maintain our feelings of decency and self-worth. Rebels and dissidents challenge the complacent belief in a just world, and as the theory would predict, they are usually denigrated for their efforts. While they are alive, they may be called cantankerous, crazy, hysterical, uppity, or duped. Dead, some of them become saints and heroes, the sterling characters of our history. But it's a matter of proportion. One angry rebel is crazy. Three is a conspiracy. 50 is a movement. Thank you.
The third reading is from Martin Luther King Jr., Beyond Vietnam, from April 4th, 1967, spoken at Riverside Church in New York. I come to this great, magnificent house of worship tonight because my conscience leaves me no other choice. I join you in this meeting because I am in deepest agreement with the aims and work of the organization that brought us together. Clergy and laymen concerned about Vietnam. The recent statements of your executive committee are the sentiments of my own heart, and I found myself in full accord when I read its opening lines. A time comes when silence is betrayal. That time has come for us in relation to Vietnam. The truth of these words is beyond doubt, but the mission to which they call us is a most difficult one. Even when pressed by the demands of inner truth, men do not easily assume the task of opposing their government's policy, especially in times of war. Nor does a human spirit move without great difficulty against all the apathy of conformists thought within one's own bosom and in the surrounding world. Moreover, when the issues at hand seem as perplexing as they often do in the case of this dreadful conflict, we are always on the verge of being mesmerized by uncertainty. We must move on. Some of us who have already begun to break the silence of the night have found that the calling to speak is often a vocation of agony. But we must speak. We must speak with all the humility that is appropriate to our limited vision. But we must speak, and we must rejoice as well, for surely this is the first time in our nation's history that a significant number of its religious leaders have chosen to move beyond the prophesying of smooth patriotism to the high grounds of a firm dissent based upon the mandates of conscience and the reading of history. Perhaps a new spirit is rising among us. If it is, let us trace its movement and pray that our inner being may be sensitive to its guidance, for we are deeply in need of a new way beyond the darkness that seems so close around us.
It is great and very fitting that we're gathered here this morning in a space that was once a Christian Science church and is now a civic temple at the heart of our city's life. This is one Saturday when I'm glad that our little civic analog to church doesn't start at too early an hour. I've just spent a week with Janae in the other Washington and in New York, speaking to all kinds of audiences and organizations about my new book, You're More Powerful Than You Think, which is a citizen's guide to exercising power. The trip was fantastic, and I will tell you today about some of the things I learned. But I was running hard every hour of every day this week, and I didn't sleep much. So now my body clock is a bit off. I've been hovering in that space where wakefulness and sleep are commingled, where the line between a dream and a memory becomes blurred. From that interstitial space, that state of mind, emerges the question I'd like us to ponder today. What's the difference between a promise you've never kept and a lie? At what point does a failure to deliver become not just an omission or a condition of regrettable tardiness, but an act of malicious deceit? That, my friends, is the American question. The American promise is what Thomas Jefferson wrote and others extended, clause by clause. It is our creedal pledge of equality under law, of liberty and justice for all, of government by and of and for the people. It is a creed we haven't yet lived up to. More than that, it is a dream. It is a dream in the sense of an aspiration for economic security and material comfort. It is a dream, too, in the sense of Martin Luther King's vision of racial integration and opportunity and equality for all. A dream exists both above and below real life. Above, in that experiences of time and space are intensified and heightened by our unleashed imaginations. Below, in that every dream trawls through the murky waters of animal instinct and base sense memory. The American dream is just like that. It's a great feat of imagination and a stirring of our basest nature. We're not sure if it's real, yet we can't seem to shake it. Today, I want to talk about three states of being in the American body politic and spirit politic: the states of sleeping, dreaming, and awakening. Sleeping. On our last night in New York, Janae and I went to Studio 54 in Manhattan. It's no longer the disco of hedonistic 1970s lore, which is too bad, because you should see us on the dance floor. especially Janae, actually. But it's now a gorgeous, intimate Broadway theater. And there we saw a celebrated new play by Lynn Nottage called Sweat. Sweat is set in Reading, Pennsylvania between the years 2000 and 2008. It chronicles a group of friends who've worked all their lives in the town's steel tubing plant as they reckon with the slow motion decimation of their factory and community. Things get complicated when one of the friends, who's black, gets promoted off the line and into management. Things get even more complicated when upper management starts squeezing the workers and locking them out until they agree to a 60% pay cut. Jobs and machines go to Mexico. A Colombian-American bartender crosses the picket line. Disaster ensues. Not the acts of God that Rebecca Solnit, in our first reading, described as generating surges of fellow feeling and collective action, but rather the acts of capitalists that yield only tragic isolation. Nottage, who wrote Sweat before the election, has said her subject was the human cost of America's deindustrial revolution. Donald Trump, more bluntly, has called it American carnage, and he vacuumed up votes in the real Reading in November. But Lynn Nottage is no Donald Trump. She is an African-American woman. She's a genius, not of the self-proclaimed kind, but of the MacArthur Fellowship kind. And she listens to other humans. She spent 2 years living in Reading, Pennsylvania, listening to the women and men, black and white, black and white and Hispanic, of every generation, who grew up believing in the certainty of their work and their sweat, and their pride, and their dignity, even as evidence mounted all around them that all would be outsourced eventually and shipped away. Out of that listening came this play, from the first moments when we sat down in that theater, it gave me the kind of lump in the throat that precedes a long and deferred cry. At various moments, often unexpected ones, I did cry. And in the final scene, tears were flowing all around me. I'm not going to give away the plot points that press these tears out, but the particulars aren't important anyway. What made me cry that evening was the grinding, inexorable tragedy of these characters who had believed in a promise that became a lie. At each scene break, images from the national news are projected onto the sets without commentary or explicit connection to the plot. Images of President Clinton and President George W. Bush, images of the stock market booming and then collapsing, images of Wall Street bailouts being announced. Barack Obama is never mentioned. And what made me cry was the unsaid truth that we learned between 2009 and today, that it wouldn't matter. Hope and change didn't happen in the Rust Belt. W's slogan was compassionate conservatism. Bill Clinton's slogan in 92 was putting people first. The truth was that no matter who was president, these people were getting screwed. Global capital was gutting local labor. There was no compassion to it. And what made me cry that night was feeling the sheer distance, the awful silent chasm between the elites who've rigged the game during my lifetime and the people who've paid the price. And what haunted me was how long I'd been asleep while this was happening in America and the complicity of my slumber. Let me back up a step. 2 weeks ago, we at Citizen University held our annual national conference. The theme was reckoning and repair in a polarized and severely unequal America. And we had speakers and teachers from many domains there to share ideas and lessons from history and politics. But I was struck by how much of the learning and teaching at the conference was either above or below politics. Above in that it was on a spiritual plane about values and moral aspiration. Below, in that it was about the forgotten fundamentals of respect and human presence, how to see each other and feel each other and recognize each other deeply, fundamentals that we've neglected in American civic life. Speaker after speaker returned to this theme of representing ourselves face to face. I recently learned about a theater company called 600 Highwaymen, who staged these beautifully immersive performances in which lines between audience and performer are smudged by invitations to touch, to sense, to feel the faces and see the eyes and bear the weight and the spirit of the people all around you. That's what we all need now. That's what we are doing now. So when I was watching Sweat that evening, I was highly attuned to those moments on stage, heartbreaking, endowed moments, when characters would hold or touch or see one another to provide small mercies and fleeting comforts that would still not be enough to compensate for the stripping away of dignity, of place and purpose. There's this refrain throughout the play, many variations of, they don't even see you. And later, I'm gonna make them see me. This is why people have been flocking to see Sweat, the same way they're flocking now to read J.D. Vance's Appalachian memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, to figure out how it happened, to empathize with the folks whose suffering and bottled up rage and shame begat Trump. Empathizing with the pain of others is good, of course, but empathy can be dangerous if it masks the underlying imbalances of power that create the pain in the first place. The prime task in the United States today is not for the privileged to witness the suffering of others. The prime task is to ask how this suffering came to be, to understand just how power was monopolized by a few to betray and diminish so many people into invisibility, and then for all of us together to change the story, even if it costs us something. The whole time I was watching Sweat, because I am a teacher of civic power, I was asking myself, what else these Reading steelworkers could have done. How else could they have organized against the financiers and the company owners? Could they have mobilized allies from other states to expand the arena? Could they have pressed the media to publicize NAFTA's effects earlier? Why didn't they band together in the face of economic disaster to revive civic clubs and associations and generate new power? Could they have put out a call for people who seemingly had nothing to do with their sector and their lives to come to Reading and stand with them? People, for instance, like me? Then I had to ask, what else could I have done while the American dream was evaporating for so many Americans? Why did it take me so long to wake up and see my fellow citizens? Dreaming. Maybe it's because I was dreaming too hard. Often people look at my life and early career, son of Chinese immigrants, product of public schools in tiny Wappingers Falls, New York, goes off to Yale and becomes a speechwriter for United States president. And they see this story as an embodiment of the American dream. I tell the story that way sometimes myself. But today, I think that when I was a young man, lost in my dreams, I was rather blind. Let me tell you about the first set of speeches I wrote for President Clinton. It was 1993, and we were planning a trip to Moscow. This would be the first time an American president had visited Russia since the fall of the Berlin Wall, the implosion of the Soviet Union, and the end of the Cold War. A few weeks before the trip, a fellow speechwriter and I sat down in the Oval Office with President Clinton to take notes as he riffed on the kinds of themes and topics he would want to address on this historic trip. I figured he would go to policy issues and diplomatic questions. I was wrong. He spent the whole time musing aloud about psychology and national character. Russia, he said, was a great nation. More, it was a great civilization. And though we in the US might celebrate the end of communism and the arrival of democracy there, and though we might frame this as a narrative of progress, we had to be careful. We had to be careful, he said, to attend to the wounded pride of the Russian people, who, after all, were now in a shaky economic situation and at the mercy of their former enemies. Though the average Russian might be relieved to be rid of a militaristic totalitarian government, much of that relief was canceled out by the anxiety and even shame of having lost superpower status. So the key, the president told us, was to help the Russian people channel their yearning for greatness and pride in a healthy and constructive direction. To tell them that meeting the challenges of creating a free market liberal democracy would be a new chance to prove in a new way the enduring greatness and resilience of this nation. I thought this was so astute at the time. It was certainly vintage Clinton, applying X-ray insight into the human psyche, and at the international scale rather than only the interpersonal. I followed the president's direction closely, layering his speeches with soulful references to the poetry and literature and music and spirit of Mother Russia. He made people feel good on that trip. He felt their pain. Of course, we know how things turned out. Clinton's counterpart, Boris Yeltsin, had been courageous in the days of liberation, but turned out to be an undisciplined leader whose cronies strip-mined the state for personal enrichment and fueled corruption, chaos, and kleptocracy everywhere. Out of that disorder and out of the nostalgia for Soviet-era certainty emerged the canny KGB operative who rules Russia today, who took personal control of the kleptocracy, and who would later help an American president get elected, who exploited American fears of lost greatness. As that president might say, sad. But it truly is sad. It truly is, because while President Clinton seemed psychologically astute and the rhetoric I wrote for him at the time sounded the right notes, we, and now I mean the United States, did not in fact show the Russian people respect. Puffing them up about their greatness and then ignoring them was not the same as actual respect. telling them that they could now have a junior version of the American dream of free markets and free elections was not the same as respect, especially when it didn't happen. A century after the Russian Revolution, that nation is great mainly in its capacity to do harm. And what's doubly sad is that we, President Clinton and his team, did not apply the same sensitivity to lost greatness and wounded pride to the swaths of our own country that were being deindustrialized by his Wall Street-friendly policies. So, what could I have done? I had no hand in NAFTA, or the Glass-Steagall repeal, or the deregulation of commodities markets, policies that forcefully tilted our economy away from labor and toward capital. It wasn't my job. It was above my pay grade. And anyway, the economy was booming in the 90s. The dot-com bubble was rising. And while I didn't quite buy the notion that textile and steel workers who'd lost their jobs to Vietnam and Mexico could suddenly now thrive selling stuff on eBay, it did seem at the time that things would work out for everyone. But I was dreaming. Even after I left the White House, I didn't question the orthodoxies of unchecked free trade. I didn't defend those orthodoxies either. I just didn't pay attention. When the costs of free trade became clearer, I didn't think of it as my problem. It was. When I think about what's happened in this country economically over my lifetime, I think I was part of the problem, mainly because I was not a part of the solution. I could have been, had I been as awake as I am today. I should have been. It was my job, whatever my professional title in the White House was, because I was a citizen of the United States who had the social capital and the connections to speak and to be heard. You can call me a product of the American dream, but in fact, I'm a product of the American meritocracy, which is not the same thing, and in fact, is often its enemy. The meritocracy of test-taking and selective colleges that made talented outsiders like Bill Clinton from Hope, Arkansas, a Rhodes Scholar, and then a US president, is about merit, only in a narrow SAT sense. And even then, only at the front end, just to get in the door. A friend of mine named Rocky told me once about his dad, who grew up in Appalachia, but got out, got educated, and became a college professor. But he never lost the aggrieved and mistrustful mindset of his Appalachian roots. As Rocky, the son of a college professor, inherited the advantages that propelled him to a very selective Eastern college, which then opened doors for a very successful career, his dad always gave off this unspoken vibe that, as Rocky put it, connections are cheating. If getting into the American meritocracy is mainly about a numerical score on a test, the preparation for which is itself influenced by inherited advantages, staying in the meritocracy is much more about who you know. This is the dirty little secret of American meritocracy. And once you're in, you are, of course, motivated to believe that you get access to awesome opportunities because you deserve it. The corollary to that, of course, is that anyone who doesn't have access to awesome opportunities doesn't deserve it. As Carol Tavris says, mistakes were made, but not by me. This self-justifying myth of a deserving elite and an undeserving everyone else has led and fed inequality in the United States and helped people at the top rationalize the way that they ignore it. It isn't necessarily surprising that the powerful have a strong instinct for self-justification, though. They need to defend their privilege, which is bound up with their identity. And they do so in ways both conscious and unconscious. What is surprising is how often the powerless join them in defending it. Psychologists call this system justification theory, and it posits that people without power tend to blame themselves for their weak position. Worse, they often actively defend the system that renders them powerless. Why? Because it sometimes can be more bearable to make excuses for the system and its inequities than to admit the possibility that you are truly without agency. The latter is a far greater threat to your dignity. Underlying all these dynamics is the presence of cognitive dissonance, that tension between the image we want to have of ourselves and our actual circumstances. Humans always resolve cognitive dissonance in ways that reduce pain. That means explaining away, rationalizing, the embarrassment of being at the bottom. It means buying into legitimizing myths, the cultural narratives and ideologies that explain why the haves have and the have-nots have not. In the words of one study by Stanford University's Rob Willer and several other scholars, quote, "The more participants reported feeling powerless, the more they believed that economic inequality was fair and legitimate," close quote. Until now. What has made a moment like ours so tumultuous and exciting and dangerous is that meritocratic trickle-down legitimizing myths have lost their grip. People without power, or who feel in relative terms that they've lost power, have decided to reject elite rationalizations of the status quo. Trump supporters and Sanders supporters may not have shared a political style or a moral palette, but they did share in spades this readiness to burn it all down. People will tell themselves a self-blaming story as long as they possibly can if it helps keep cognitive dissonance at bay. And in America, that's a very long time, because our hyper-individualistic culture blinds us to forces beyond the control of, well, an individual. But when enough evidence accumulates that the game is truly crony rigged, and that merit and effort have little to do with assent, that justice is not blind but instead winks at the powerful, there comes a forceful snap back to reality, literally a disillusionment. The pain of such disillusionment can be converted to action and reform, as during the American Revolution or the Civil Rights Movement, or it can lead to an utterly paralyzing cynicism. We are in a world of such pain today. The key variable now is whether citizens will wake up and remember how to claim their own power. Awakening. What does it mean to be awakened? Some activists I know have come to resent the way that white establishment liberals are bending over backwards these days to empathize with white Trump voters. When whites face a drug epidemic, they note, there are calls for compassion and treatment instead of mass incarceration and military-grade policing. When angry white voters elect a man who gives courage and cover to bigotry and hate, we are asked to understand the pain and fear that motivated them instead of the pain and fear they are now generating among non-white others. It's a valid point. In fact, it's nearly impossible to deny. Yet, I cannot shut down the impulse to understand. And I do not think that awakening or empathy need to be zero sum. Because when I see a piece of art like Sweat, or when I read a similar work by my friend Robert Schenken's, The Kentucky Cycle, a Pulitzer-winning set of 10 short plays that take place between the 1770s and the 1970s on the same piece of ground in coal country. What I see is not white people getting too much coddling for having too many feelings of unrequited entitlement. What I see is an opportunity to deliver on an unmet promise. What I see is a bright, thick thread of a movement for renewal and reform. This desire to be seen, to be recognized, to not be overlooked or discarded or treated as a tool or an inert object or an obstacle. This desire is what connects Redding to Ferguson, rural opioid addicts to young urban gangsters, fast food workers to coal miners, migrant farm workers to Muslim refugees. This desire to be seen is the stuff of an awakening. It is the stuff of a broad and diverse coalition of people united by their yearning to be somebody, to live the American promise of opportunity and reward for striving. Who can activate this desire in a way that elevates rather than scapegoats? Who can connect these isolated stories of disenfranchisement into a grand epic of empowerment. We can. Throughout American history, and especially in the 18th and 19th centuries, this land was set afire by religious revivalism. These great awakenings, as they were called, initially fire and brimstone and later more ecstatically evangelical, always tracked deep shifts in our society. The violent theft of native lands, the consolidation of slavery, the urbanization and then the industrialization of the economy, the rise of speculative finance, and the financial panics, many depressions, that broke out every few decades in this country. All these tectonic shifts generated volcanic bursts of collective spiritual searching among white citizens. And all that religious seeking yielded massive social reforms every generation or two, from abolition to prohibition to women's suffrage to the progressive era's curbing of monopolistic capitalism to the civil rights movement. In the 21st century, we are a less churched nation. But all of us gathered here this morning are evidence that the human impulse for rebirth and renewal and great awakening is timeless, and it is secular as well as religious. Or, to use the language of Civic Saturdays, it is civic religious. When I speak of American civic religion, I mean not only the kinds of civic scripture we heard read earlier. What animates the texts is the spirit. And what the spirit of Jefferson and Lincoln and King tell me today is that it's time to wake up. We are either going to die a slow national death, lost in the loops of our segregated, self-justifying dreams, or we are going to set in motion a rejuvenation together. Simply by showing up today, you are saying you choose rebirth. You are a part of the vanguard that will do the work of stitching movements and communities together into a bigger story. The greatness of America lies and arises not when the people scrape for scraps beneath the indifferent gaze of a moneyed and merit-badged elite. The greatness of America arises when the people unite to push back and share in power and opportunity. How do we convert this awakening into something coherent and durable? Let me tell you what I've learned in the first week of travels on my book tour. First, we've got to make a bigger story of us. Among my progressive friends, intersectionality is a buzzword these days. Connecting various self-identified causes like feminism and racial justice and other progressive causes. But deep intersectionality expands that in-group to include white and black workers in the South who voted Trump but are literally getting chewed up in the auto parts factories that had moved from Mexico back to Mississippi and Alabama when big corporations realized they could exploit Southern labor just like they exploited Mexican labor. I call this Confederate capitalism. And there was a cover story in a recent issue of Bloomberg Businessweek that exposed its ravages. The pressure from foreign auto and auto parts companies in complicity with union-busting state governments to force low-wage workers to work extra shifts with no safety precautions or recourse or remedy. When I read that, I was pissed. I thought, that's just wrong. This is America. And then I thought, these workers should be allies with the people of Standing Rock and the people of $15 Now and the people of Black Lives Matter and others who are getting screwed right now by other systems of concentrated power. There's a big affirmative story of us that we can all fit into. It's a story bigger than resistance. It's a story bigger than party or region. It's about work that means something and that makes you feel you mean something. It's about a sense of place, a sense of purpose that can carry you through hard times. This story can have an obstacle, this self-serving meritocratic elite, but it need not have an enemy. As the psychologist Gordon Allport observed in his classic book, The Nature of Prejudice, the desire for security within a group can be achieved without hostility toward an out-group. We just have to make it truly safe inside. Which brings me to my second lesson. We've got to show each other how to say what we are scared of and what we are ashamed of. We've begun that today. We've got to show each other how to name our pain. This, and not scapegoating, is how we can build bonds that will truly liberate us. And this point hit me last week when I was speaking at a place called Civic Hall in New York City. During the Q&A after my talk, a young African-American woman asked for counsel on how to speak about politics to her relatives in Georgia who had supported Donald Trump and who were repelled by her liberal views. My suggestion to her was not to speak about politics, at least politics as we know it, but rather to go beneath and to speak about her fears, to explain to her kin why she's afraid of persecution or condescension, to reveal in what ways she is insecure and where she is trying to shield a weakness or a wound, to own up to her own failings, moral and otherwise. To do this is to lead by example, to invite others to drop their guard. We have all been imprisoned by our histories, and we so often disrespect others to remedy the deficit of respect that we ourselves have experienced. The night I was at Civic Hall, I had to miss another event going on uptown at historic Riverside Church, a commemoration of the historic speech that Martin Luther King Jr. had delivered there 50 years earlier, in which, as we heard, he spoke out for the first time against the Vietnam War and tied the civil rights struggle to the anti-war struggle. That speech made King immensely unpopular in many quarters. LBJ disinvited him from the White House, and that is part of why it is important. It laid the groundwork for a poor people's campaign that King set in motion the next year, in which civil rights and economic justice and peace would merge into a single revolutionary movement for respect. But then he was assassinated, a year to the day after his Riverside speech. After his death, Americans came to sanctify a safer King, one who spoke of dreams in hopeful language and who could be used as a messenger of reconciliation and even colorblindness. The more radical, more fully awakened King that emerged late in his life is less remembered, but more necessary now. This King was unafraid to speak truth, both to power and to his own allies in the fight against concentrated power. And this is the third and final lesson I wish to share. Let's be brutally honest about the challenges we face so that we can be brutally honest in our demands. In recent weeks, I've noticed in Seattle big visually arresting signs being pasted onto buildings and street structures in the Central District saying, "We deserve rent control." Perhaps so. But the blunt truth is, to quote a line used in both the Clint Eastwood Western Unforgiven and the HBO Baltimore crime series, The Wire, deserve ain't got nothing to do with it. If you want change, don't make an appeal to just deserts. Make a map of who decides, whether it's about rent control or homelessness or taxes or healthcare, and make a plan to locate and pressure those deciders or to replace them or to become one of them. Then make an alliance with others to mobilize the crowds, the money, the media attention, the social norms pressure, and the state actors needed to execute that plan. In one of my last meetings last week, I visited with Dale Ho, who directs voting rights litigation for the National ACLU. He has a degree from Yale, and he's using it to serve not himself, but his constitution. His small but mighty team files lawsuits in every state where right-wing white insiders are trying to rig the voting rules to keep young and non-white outsiders from the ballot box. It's a daunting task, but Dale is a calm dude. He has a plan. He has a plan to re-rig the game, state by state. Power concedes nothing without a demand, Frederick Douglass told us. Let me add that that a demand means nothing without a plan. At the start of this morning, I asked, What's the difference between a promise you never kept and a lie? I hope you've been pondering that as I've described this arc from dead sleep to willful dreaminess to full wakefulness. And I want to close now with another question. What will you do to deliver on the American promise? All around us today, a great civic surge is underway. Americans, young and old, are getting activated for the first time or the first time in a very long time. We don't always know what we're doing, but the important thing is that we're doing. We can teach each other how to do it, how to practice power with more skill and wisdom and a deeper sense of history and our moment. We can read books of strategy like mine and many others. We can learn by trial and error with joy and fellowship. But one thing each of us must do first is to be clear about what we're willing to lose. The risks of showing up and participating in times of upheaval, of something like revolution, are real. The risk of disappointment, of failure, of financial penalty, or reputational damage, or bodily harm. But here's the reward. Living as if you were wide awake, fully human, and not alone. For the sake of our country and the ideals for which it stands, let's take that chance together. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I hope to see you all again on May 20th. And Scott, take it away.
I'm not nervous anymore. But I'm confused. I'm all stirred up. And I don't know what else to do but to sing about it. All right, so if you feel any of that energy and you want to get it out, let's sing about it together. Shall we, dear? This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I was walking that ribbon of highway, saw above me that endless skyway. I saw below me that golden valley. This land was made for you and me. I've roamed and rambled and followed my footsteps, sparkling sands of her diamond deserts. And all around me, a voice was sounding. This land was made for you and me. When the sun came shining, and I was strolling, and the wheat fields waving, and the dust clouds rolling, as the fog was lifting, a voice was chanting. This land was made for you and me. Was a big high wall there that tried to stop me. A sign was painted, said private property. But on the backside, it didn't say nothing. That side was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. This land was made for you and me.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Eric Liu is an author and educator. His latest book is You're More Powerful Than You Think, A Citizen's Guide to Making Change Happen. He and the Citizen University team took to the stage at Town Hall Seattle on Saturday, April 8th. Tune in again soon. You just fade.